God would, quote, raise up adversity against you, or David, from your own house. And that consequence we saw in our last class begins to develop in chapter 13, where we read about David's oldest son, Amnon, who commits sexual immorality against his half-sister Tamar. It's a very terrible thing that we see within this chapter. And in reading that chapter, in reading chapter 13, you can't help but see that the Holy Spirit is wanting us, I think, to draw a parallel between David's sin and Amnon's sin. There's a lot of similarities. There are differences, for sure. But there are a lot of similarities and parallels in what happens between David's sin and Amnon's sin. And what that means is that David is confronted with having to address a situation where his own son has, you know, really sort of done the same type of thing that he has. And David is confronted with this need where he really should administer justice according to God's law against his son. And yet David had experienced what from God? Complete forgiveness, a complete release from the law's demand in chapter 12. And so what does David do in response to Amnon's sin? Do you remember? What's the text say? Okay, all right, that's concerning Absalom a few chapters later. We'll get to that. But how about Amnon? Okay, it says he became angry in verse 21 of chapter 13. But when you ask the question, what did he really do? He did nothing. Nothing is recorded. In fact, it would seem in the following verses that life just kind of went on, right? And ultimately, this ends up being a problem. We talked about how the New Revised Standard Version, the Septuagint, some others, include some additional information that may or may not be valid, but are consistent with other scriptural verses that indicate that David became very angry, but he would not punish his son Amnon, for he loved him, for he was his firstborn. Right? So David may have struggled greatly with just sort of how to deal with this with his son, and failed in doing so. You wanted to say something? Exactly. Right. And the first thing you said I want to bring up, because Heather and I were talking about this last night. Yeah, I've tried within this class to say, you know, here's what I think I see happening. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've probably heard me say that a few times. And that's in part because there's some challenging things to how to study this book. We're not told outright, here's the problem. David did not do this. We're left to watch how David and others respond to things, and then we have to take God's principles and apply them. That's what I'm trying to do, right? So, you know, it doesn't come right out and say David was wrong not to do anything and only be angry. But yet, I think we see, number one, God's demand was that he should have done something. And number two, everything falls apart afterward. It leads to more problems, right? And so what you're drawing out of on is that David may have been very hesitant, paralyzed, because what if Amnon were to come to him and say, well, you did the same thing, David, Dad. So sin has, it would seem, paralyzed David and led him to inaction. Well, Absalom was another son of David. He was the brother of Tamar, who had been violated. Absalom graciously takes Tamar in and cares for her, but how else does he respond? With mercy? Forgiveness? Okay. It's actually in the very next verse in chapter 13, verse 22. Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because of what he had done with Tamar. And what does Absalom ultimately do to Amnon? Okay, murder him. And then flees, runs north to his mother's father, the king of Geshur, where it says that he stayed for 3 years in verse 38. Verse 39 seems to suggest that that over time, David became at peace with, or was comforted, I should say, regarding Amnon's death. And it seems that he longed for Absalom. It says in verse 39, King David longed to go to Absalom. And then verse 14, the king, or chapter 14, verse 1, that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. So it would seem that David would want to bring Absalom back or was concerned about that. Why didn't he? This is one of those tough questions to me. Yeah, okay, the silence is either I asked the question poorly or it's kind of tough to figure out. It's one or the other. As far as I understand chapter 14, that chapter suggests to me that David knew that he would have to, if he brought Absalom back, he would have to address Absalom's actions. I mean, what is he going to do? Administer justice is what he knows he should do. And that may be what he knows in his heart, and it may be what some of the populace would expect of him. But I think that when Joab in chapter 14, and this was the last thing we studied, sends this woman of Tekoa to him, and David is self-convicted by how he responds to the situation, you learn within that situation that David was struggling with this idea that justice has to be administered, and yet, you know, he's battling with this. He's been shown grace by God. I think what happens is that David brings Absalom back when he self-convicts himself. It's half-hearted. We talked about last time in chapter 14 and verse 24. What does David do? He allows Absalom to come back, but what can't Absalom do? He would not allow his son to come see his face. Now, why would he do that? Text doesn't tell us, but why might he do that? Okay, see, I think the silence that time was because we struggle with what exactly has happened here. Here's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think David was led in that self-convicting of the story of from the woman of Tekoa to see that maybe there's a justification, maybe I can show grace. And yet, as he brings David back, I think he struggles with the idea of showing complete grace, and it's half-hearted. What does that produce in Absalom, that half-hearted forgiveness? What's that? Okay, rebellion and bitterness, and in the end of chapter 14, he says in verse 32, Absalom says, "Why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now therefore let me see the king's face, but if there is sin, if there is iniquity in me, let him execute me." I mean, I think Absalom understood. There's a principle here. If I have done something wrong, I should be held accountable for it. My interpretation of this is that he should have. I think David was led to be convinced that maybe there's justification for him not to carry out the requirements of the law, but I don't think he was directed by God to do that. That's my interpretation of this. At the same time, I do think the logic of the woman of Tekoa is correct when she says in the middle of her speech, verse 14, "God does not take away a life, but he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him." Does God do that? Does God make a means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him? He does. In fact, he did that for David, right? But I think David is struggling with kind of how to balance all that in his own actions. What did David really need to do? My understanding is carry out the will of God. He could have gone to inquire of God, "How do I handle this, Lord? I'm struggling with the fact that I have to do this." But I think David had to trust in God and carry out his will. So, I've taken 10 minutes, and I'm supposed to be past this chapter. But here's where I want to leave this, okay? Here's where I want to leave this. Number one, two main points. Number one, we talked in our class about the hesitation, the paralysis, the lack of confidence, and the weakness that can beset us when we sin. And I think we see that in David. This quote from Bob Waldron in his commentary is very strong to me. It says, "When Nathan told David that the sword would not depart from his house, the promise would come to pass because David was paralyzed by his own guilt and would not act decisively to bring his sons under control. In other words, for God's prophecy to be fulfilled, he would need do nothing but let the results of David's sin take their course." That's powerful to me to think about. And you see that, right, in the playing out of what happens in these chapters. The second point I want to make, and I said this in a couple of conversations I had after last Sunday's class individually with people. I think maybe chapter 14 is the most challenging chapter for me to understand in the book, and one of the more challenging ones in the Bible, really. But I think at the same time, I can't help but consider that maybe that chapter 14 is one of the most potent chapters in the Bible for glorifying God's balance of justice and mercy. Here's what I mean by that. There's a struggle, I think, that is going on with how do you deal with this? God's showing of grace, the justice that is demanded. There's when things are out of balance, there are problems. You know, I want to make sure I get it right. It's like first David's angry but then does nothing. That's a problem. Then David's afraid to show grace due to the expectation of justice, but then in showing grace, he's hesitant to go all the way, and then even the one he's showing grace to understands that if there is guilt, he should be punished. So it's like we all understand the need for justice, and yet at the same time, we all know that we need grace. God solved that in the most perfect way possible in Jesus Christ. And that's what I'm trying to get across when I say maybe this is one of the more potent chapters for glorifying God, in that in Jesus Christ, He has both executed justice and brought grace. Okay. In other words, to your point is that he couldn't have made a right action because God was bringing something towards him. Yeah. Well, I mean, God had pronounced that the consequences would come, right? Mimi. Yeah. Right, our sins are going to affect a wide swath of people, especially our family, right? And we see that here. You know, I raised the question, you know, what if David had never brought Absalom back? Now, God's consequence is going to be fulfilled. I don't know how it's going to happen. But at the same time, David's bringing Absalom back, and then this half-heartedness about it, not letting Absalom see his face, produces the bitterness that you see at the end of chapter 14 that explodes in the full-blown rebellion in chapter 15, right? So that's where the fuse is lit and it blows up in chapter 15. I want to go on to chapter 15 now. Reading beginning in verse 1, it says that after this it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And so it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Well, your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Well, then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice." So it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. It came to pass after 4 years that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt at Geshur in Syria, saying, 'If the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' And he arose and went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron.' And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy drew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. The rebellion begins. Let me ask you this question. How does Absalom steal the hearts of the men of Israel? What are some of the things that you see? Deception how? Okay. Really, deception, good point, undergirds everything that he does right here. What are some of the specifics? Okay, super friendly with them. Shows personal interest. I think that's part of why the question is, where are you from? Let's talk. What's that? Okay, it's like the kissing babies, right? This is the preeminent politician here. He's kissing those that come by. Why, how else? He's kind of, pointing at David's administration, saying they're not doing their job. But if I were in charge, I would. So there's an accusation there, creating the impression that the current leader was not fulfilling his role. Right? Which, if that were the case, what should Absalom have been doing? Like, if David's administration wasn't carrying out their job, what should Absalom have done? Okay, right. Perhaps should have approached his dad and said, hey, I see a concern here. Let's work together. How can we address this? That's not what he's doing at all, is he? No. What else do you see? What's the deal with the horses and the chariots and the 50 men? All right, he's got the look, right? And so, the ring is of Saul and those things that were looked at in the past. And so he wanted to go for the look, right? It says in verse 2 that he would rise early. I think we're supposed to see, hey, sometimes to subvert a kingdom takes some hard work, takes some initiative, and so he's getting up early. Yeah. Sure. Sure, yeah, so yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So he's described as super handsome and the full head of hair and all that kind of thing, and then he's surrounding himself with the trappings at the same time, right? He said in verse 3, Absalom would say to the people that he talked to, look, your case is good and right. And I think what we're supposed to mean from that is like pretty much everybody talked, yeah, you've got a case here. Yeah, you've got a case. You know, these two might have been against you. Yeah, you've got a case here. We got to deal with that. So, it would seem that he is, in effect, kind of justifying everyone. Then when he says to his father, let me go down to Hebron, what's his rationale for it? I'm fulfilling an oath that I made to Jehovah, right? I'm just appealing to the religious side as well. Is there anything that he does from this point onward that tells you that he's really concerned with following Jehovah's will? No. And also, it raises the question of, well, how come it took this long? It's been years. How come it took this long for you to come to the point of fulfilling the vow? So you see all of these things, the giving the look, working hard behind the scenes, showing a personal interest, justifying everybody, creating impressions that the current leadership is not doing their job. I just want to point out that congregations have been brought to ruin by people exhibiting the very same qualities, right? And that's why I wanted to highlight that idea of Absalom. If there's a problem that needs addressing, the claim the leadership isn't handling things, the reaction is not to go talking about it on the outside and drawing, personal allegiance to yourself. The way to deal with it is go to leadership, address that directly. And to see kind of how this rebellion occurs is to look into the hearts of those that lead those type of rebellions and to challenge ourselves to make sure, hey, we're not carrying any of those same concerns or qualities. Right. Oh, great observation. That's great. You know, for this rebellion to have occurred, it raises the question, what must have, not all of the people, but many of the people thought about David? I mean, Absalom didn't kind of rise up and then, you know, everybody's on David's side and, oh, okay, well, there had to have been some concerns, discontent. I don't know if the sins that had been committed were causing problem or how he had dealt with Absalom. I don't know, but there's a lot of folks that were stolen and ready to side with Absalom in this. Okay. Right. So kind of the earthly motivations seem to have, for those that are supporting Absalom, the rebellion. Well, so David in verse 13 hears about what's happening very quickly, realizes we're going to be overrun and smashed quickly, and he begins fleeing with those who are with him. I think there's a lot of things that we could do with verses 13 to 37. I'm going to structure it this way. I want to talk about three people that are identified in these verses and some things that we see about them and their friendship with David, their allegiance to him. It's important to recognize there are more than three friends that flee with David. In verses 14 and 15, it says, all of his servants joined him, and they say, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. Verse 16 says, David's household joins him, though he leaves 10 concubines behind to keep the house. All the Cherethites, Pelethites, Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath are mentioned. There were children included among them in verse 22. All of the Levites join in verse 24. And while there are a number that rebel with Absalom among the country, I mean, a very large number from the way things are described, yet there are a very large number of people that weep with a loud voice, according to verse 23, as this fleeing happens. It's not clear to me, at least I haven't seen it. Somebody raise your hand if you know where there's something more concrete. How many people joined with David in leaving, but at most there were maybe a few thousand, I think. Certainly in the next chapter it was thought that a force of 12,000 would just smash those with David and cause them to flee. I want to talk, though, about three people that are identified specifically. The first one is Ittai the Gittite. Anybody know where a Gittite was from? The Gittites were from the city of Gath, right? The Gittite and Gath names are related to one another. And so Ittai, as I understand it, would have been from Gath of Philistia. And it would seem, by the description of verses 19 and 20, that he and those with him had abandoned the Philistines. Perhaps we're meant to understand that they had renounced their citizenship. They're described as exiles in the New King James Version. And they had flipped allegiance from Philistia to who? To David, to Israel. And there may be some connection with David's previous exploits, both among the Philistines and against the Philistines, but Ittai is one of those that has come from Philistia. What does Ittai want to do? He wants to go with David. He wants to flee. What does David say in response? Yeah. why would you do that? That's essentially, why would you do that? You know, and he basically says to Ittai, you're an exile and foreigner from your own people. You just got here. You know, you don't want to be caught up in this. And his words in verse 19 are interesting. Why are you also going with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. Did you catch that? It seems to me that David's referring to Absalom as king. I don't think he accepts that Absalom is the rightful king, but it's almost like a setup for Ittai. Go to Absalom, serve him. You don't want to be a part of this rebellion. To which Ittai responds, how? Yeah. I'm going with you. In fact, let me read it. Verse 21. But Ittai answered the king and said, as Jehovah lives. Remember, this guy's from Philistia, right? As Jehovah lives, and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also your servant will be. Both the reference to Jehovah and the reference to David as my lord the king says to David, this guy is committed. How encouraging must this have been to David? Yeah, and he goes on to say, okay, you can come along, and young ones come with them, and that. But you know, the words in verse 21 to me are very reminiscent of another foreigner who spoke similar words to someone that was a Jew. Who am I thinking of? Oh, do I have it up there? So that was poor planning. Doesn't it remind you, though, of Ruth's words to Naomi? Right? You're not going to have, I've got Ruth 1, like, inscribed in my wedding band, right? Nobody's got Ittai the Gittite inscribed in their wedding band, right? But the spirit is the same and just as powerful, isn't it? David is encouraged by this, and you know, really, you've got Ittai the Gittite over here, and then you've got Absalom, the son of the anointed king, over here, and the contrast couldn't be more different as to who is devoted to the Lord, right? So, there's no greater contrast that, hey, you know, just because you're from the right stock doesn't make you one of God's people. It's faith. It's where your devotion lies, and Ittai demonstrates that. Okay, so probably poor planning with all my questions as I go through each of these. Then there's Zadok, and I don't want to leave out Abiathar, but Zadok and Abiathar come out of the city, and what do they have with them? What's that? They have the Ark of the Covenant with them, and the Levites are with them, so these are the priests that are coming out. Zadok and Abiathar are the priests. And they are ready to follow with the ark. To which David responds, how? Take it back. Yeah, go back into the city. And you wonder why. I mean, you can raise the question of why would David send the ark back? Well, perhaps to keep it safe, perhaps to keep it in Jerusalem, perhaps because he doesn't want to give any appearance of, you know, what we saw back in 1 Samuel, which is, you know, depending on the box for a claim to God's partnership, as opposed to relying fully on the grace of God. Dale Ralph Davies, I like a quote that he has here. He says, David will not consent even to the appearance of a have ark, have God mentality. He will not repeat the fiasco of 1 Samuel 4:3. David says his restoration, should there be such, does not depend on whether he had Yahweh's furniture, but on whether he has Yahweh's favor. All rests on grace. David's confidence may have been shaken through his sin here, but where is his heart right now? It's humbly resting on, you know, if God pleases to bring us to ruin, so be it. But if God pleases to bring me back to restoration, it will occur. Whether the ark is with him or not does not matter. David sends Zadok back to be an informant. Perhaps that's part of the reason why he asked the question, are you not a seer? That would imply that he's a prophet and that God would reveal what he needs to know. So Zadok and Abiathar go back with the ark into the city, and David and all the people are climbing the Mount of Olives, right, as they're exiting Jerusalem on the east, and their heads are covered, and there's all this sadness. And at that time, a word comes to David. Verse 31, someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Who's Ahithophel? All right, this is David's, I shouldn't put that up there. Ahithophel is David's counselor. We are told in the next chapter that his counsel was like as if one inquired at the oracle of God. You know, the strength, the reputation of this counsel was very mighty. Now, that news to David, on the one hand, could be very discouraging, right? What does David do about it? Same verse. Yeah, I think of it as like a Nehemiah prayer. it doesn't seem like it was long in length. We have no idea how long he may have stopped to kneel or pray this, but he's on his way up the hill, right? I mean, they're fleeing fast, and he takes time to pray about this. O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Remember that prayer. The very next verse, who comes up over the hill? It's Hushai. It is Hushai the Archite, who is described in verse 37 and in other verses as David's friend. I could not be more excited about Hushai, because I believe that we are meant to see the connection in verses 31 and 32 and I'm kind of giving away a sense of the mystery in the story by saying so, but Hushai is the answer to David's prayer. That's how this turns out. And the question we're left with is, well, what if David didn't turn to God? What if David didn't pray? Hushai and his coming over the hill, now we're going to see how this is true, but Hushai coming over the hill says that God knew that David would pray. I mean, it's not like the prayer happened and all of a sudden, boom, Hushai's household's busy. It seems that all of this happened almost concurrently, which says something about God's foreknowledge, says something about his power and his providence, and it's exciting and amazing to see that right after David's prayer, Hushai appears. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I like that. So Russ is bringing out, it says something about David's spirit and his reliance on God and his belief in that his prayer is answered. Why would you say that? What does he tell Hushai to do? Sure. And what does he overall tell him to do? Maybe you can overcome the counsel of Ahithophel. Right? And he had just prayed about it. So it would seem that David draws the connection that Hushai is the answer to this prayer, which says everything about where he believed where he believed his deliverance was going to come from, and that God was walking with him and would answer this prayer. It's exciting to see this. So Hushai, it says something about Hushai too, that he takes on this role, that he goes. Right, so Hushai goes into Jerusalem to seek to try to become a voice in the ear of the king that could overcome Ahithophel's counsel. Now, when you get into chapter 16, and maybe I should point this out. So here's Jerusalem on the west side of the Dead Sea and the river as they are going to escape Jerusalem, they're going to go eastward and down. It's like, I think the number I saw was 3,700 feet. Some of you might have been out there. It's a long decline to the wilderness or the plains right beside the Jordan River. And they're going to cross over and they're going to head over to the east side. As they are cresting the hill of the Mount of Olives, they're about to head downward. That's where we get to chapter 16. And I want to structure this as looking at three, I'm going to call them enemies, but that kind of tells you where I think these guys land. three enemies that we see in 2 Samuel chapter 16. And it begins in the first four verses with Ziba. Ziba's story, who is Ziba? We were introduced to him already, right, in chapter 9. Ziba is was a servant in the household of Saul. David makes him a servant to Mephibosheth's household. Mephibosheth is the grandson of Saul that David has brought to Jerusalem, has given him a seat at the king's table. We talked about the kindness of David shown towards Mephibosheth in this. Well, David and all of these are fleeing over the hill, and who shows up but Ziba at the top of the hill? And who is with them, or what is with them? Lots of goodies, right? He's got animals that are loaded down with all kinds of good stuff, right? And what is his story? Yeah, so that is interesting. So there are two things here that make you go, right? The first thing is that, you know, we just saw Hushai, and he's showing up with ashes on his head and looking all dirty, and everybody's fleeing really quickly. But then it's like Ziba's picture at the top of the hill, and he's loaded down. Oh, I've got all this for you, king, and for your servants, right? I'm just ready to go. Here you go. This is like, how did you get all that together, ready to go so quickly? The second thing is when David says, well, where's Mephibosheth? So Mephibosheth's back in Jerusalem. He didn't want to come because he says, today God is going to give the house, you know, give the house of Saul back the kingship. Is that what it looked like? Who's rebelling here? this is Absalom, son of David, who is rebelling. It doesn't make any sense to me that the claim that Mephibosheth would have been thinking, all right, it's now happening, I'm going to come back in power. Now, you can also say, well, maybe that's the case. Maybe Mephibosheth had fooled himself into thinking that. But we're going to see Ziba again in the future. And all I want to do right now is just leave the idea that maybe Ziba's not telling the whole truth here. Right? So we'll talk about him some more when we go on. David, however, makes a snap decision and says, well, all that Mephibosheth has, I bestow on you. And Ziba goes along with them. Shimei is in verses 5 through 14. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. Let me read that, actually. I'm going to read that section. It says, when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came, and he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on David's right hand and on his left. Also Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you've reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. So now you are caught in your own evil, because you're a bloodthirsty man. Such as Shimei. You probably noted, verse 5, that he's of the family of the house of Saul, and his curses are related to that. And he's accusing David of, you know, of wrongness in destroying the house of Saul. Is there truth to that? I don't think that's the whole truth. There's some things that will come up later that will make us think, but I think he is stating things that aren't historically accurate. What is Abishai's response to this? Yeah, you need to take off his head. What is David's response to this? he's aghast at Abishai, right? We've seen that kind of thing before. What have I did you? The sons of Zeruiah are, wow, their first reaction is violent, right? It's vengeful. David says no. Verse 10, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? He's speaking to Abishai, one who was with him. So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and all his servants, see how my son who came from my own body seeks my life? How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. You know, as I read this, again, this is what I understand. Correct me if you believe I'm wrong in this, but my understanding would be consistent with really all the commentaries that I referenced in this, and in that I don't see anywhere that David had a direct revelation that he knew God had put words into the mouth of Shimei. I don't think we're meant to understand it that way, that David literally thought that. All three of the commentaries that I went through on this passage suggest that David thought that perhaps God had moved Shimei to curse him. Reading from Bob Waldron, hope he doesn't mind me doing this, I quote him often, don't I? David saw a much more complex situation than Abishai did. Abishai saw an irritant that could easily be removed. David wrestled with the knowledge of his weakness before the Lord and did not know whether his present difficulties were consequences of his sins. Perhaps the Lord had moved Shimei to curse him. If so, then how could David or anyone question what he was doing? In a later portion, he says, David does not know whether the Lord had moved Shimei to curse him, but he planned to accept humbly what was happening to him until the Lord took action. He will wait for the Lord to requite him good for Shimei's cursing. So in response to that, I say, well, you know, David says, here's what the Lord has done, but we don't see anywhere that God revealed that directly to him. How would he know that? I think it makes more sense that in seeing Absalom rise up, and with David fleeing right now, he understands that God's pronouncement, the judgment that he had made long before, after the sin with Bathsheba and Uriah, is happening now. He knows that what is happening, his fleeing from Jerusalem, is according to God's will. It may be that he understands that, hey, what's happening to me now and the cursing that is happening could all be a part of what God said would be in store for me. In the future? Okay, all right. So ultimately, I think that's what we're to key in on is what he says in verse 12, right? Like, the way to respond to this is not vengeance, not punishment. The way to respond to this is to trust in God. Right? I know God meant to judge me. He also knows that God has made some pretty wonderful promises, and that all of this is pointed, if he believes, to a resolution that God will bring about. He knows not how, but, you know, what has Absalom done? Absalom has rebelled against the Lord's anointed. You know, all of that attitude that he had towards how he's to treat the Lord's anointed in 1 Samuel, in the beginning of 2 Samuel, now Absalom is challenging the Lord's anointed. He knows that God will bring that to ruin. And so his trust in verse 11, though it's couched in terms, it may be that the Lord will do this, it may be that some... His trust ultimately is in God's decision, and that is so commendable. I want to talk about Ahithophel, though. He is very highly regarded counselor, verse 23, I've already referred to. He defects and joins Absalom's rebellion, becomes a counselor to Absalom as he was to David. What is his first counsel? It's, Absalom, you go and you take David's concubines in the sight of all the people, and it will solidify the wedge between you and David, and between those, essentially those that serve you and those that serve David. What horrifying counsel to begin your period of service to Absalom with. Absalom does it, and in so doing fulfills some of the things that God said would happen back in chapter 12. Well, Hushai is there as well. Hushai is going to get his chance to give some counsel contrary to Ahithophel's in just a little bit. And we're going to see that prayer and its fulfillment play out as we get into the next chapter. I don't know how we'll do it, but chapters 18 through 20 next time. Make sure you read that far. Thank you.